Maybe I should answer the question about my legitimacy of being here before I say anything further. And first of all, yes, I'm not only it's not only tolerated by my community that I'm here, but encouraged. And these objections against ecumenical activities like the letter by Cardinal Ratzinger, they are relatively rare. They, as I said yesterday in answering a question, they show where the wind is blowing from, but the general attitude towards ecumenism, even of the Vatican, is very positive. The Pope personally is very much in favor of this, of ecumenism. These seem like little things to us in the West, but I think sisters and brothers from the East will appreciate little gestures like that far more than we do. For instance, when in Assisi, at a very large ecumenical gathering two or three years ago, the Pope sat just in a bus.
Well, the advantages of celibacy and on the long term is that it's a very peaceful way to live, because you, as you refrain from any type of sexual activity, because in the Buddhist rules it's so strict that any possible form of intentional erotic behavior is forbidden and quite heavily punished. So not only is just relationships, but any form of erotic behavior is totally forbidden. And I remember when I first became a monk and realized what this would mean, I was a bit, I was really quite worried, because I couldn't imagine living for very long in such strict conditions. But in the long run, it really, one found ways of, because of the meditation and the intention of my life, then I didn't really find it that much of a problem. And over the long term, then it's very peaceful, because like sexual and erotic activities are very exciting to the mind. And so you always, if you stir your mind up with even sexual fantasy, you really lose any calm or peacefulness. And also the energy that is wasted, say if you're not in a family, if you're dedicated toward a family life, then that is an important part of family experience. And not to despise or deny its importance in the life of a human community. But for a monk or nun, our lives are dedicated to this supreme goal, rather than towards procreating and having a love relationship with another individual. Our whole aim is a total love and commitment to the truth or the Dhamma, and therefore all our energy must be channeled toward that, so that in the celibacy you also have tremendous power, developing very powerful mind through using the energy that would otherwise, say, go through sexual activity. And since there's no possibility for that, then it is channeled into spiritual activity. And in the long run, then it's a very peaceful and very powerful to have a celibate life. And it's not repressive, and it's not miserable. In fact, it's very free, very relief, actually, that one doesn't have to do those kind of things. And I'm very grateful that I don't have to have that kind of relationship. Because I find
a serious problem in communities, and I know of communities who tackle that task very generously, but still there's not much monastic life left. It becomes sort of an old age home. And this will become more and more and more so in the present monasteries. So that outlook for the nearest future is pretty grim. But I see the possibility. I can't see the, say that I see it happening very much yet, but I see a clear possibility in which participation of those many people who are hungering for monastic life in it will sort of swell the ranks of monastics in a possibly unprecedented way. And that is what I would like to explore a little with you. That I mentioned that monastic instinct of the human heart. Well, we spoke about it yesterday already. The heart of every religion is the religion of the heart. And the heart, in this sense, is that innermost core of our being, that center of our being, where we know that we are, that we belong, where we know that we are one with all, and not only with all humans, but with the whole cosmos, with all animals and plants and so forth. And out of this deep knowledge of the heart, we also have this great longing to realize that around us, not only within us, but around us. And so we are trying to change the world, to change our environment. And monastic life is one particular form in which this is done very radically. And this little part then of the world, this very small part, which we call the monastery, is a little world in which ideally everything is so arranged that it fosters that sense of belonging, that it fosters that deepest longing of the human heart through moment by moment mindfulness. And I would put great stress on the monastery as a place, as an environment. Yes, of course, this environment is maintained by the people who live there. Without the people, it could not go on. But it has gone on for a long time before these people came there, in many cases, and it will go on, we hope, for a long time after all these people are gone. So the important thing, I'm trying to get you to switch the emphasis here, because we are very much inclined to think of the monastery, well, that's the people and the place, and because people mean so much to us, so much more than things, we think mostly of the people. Switch for a moment and think of the environment. Think of the monastery as an environment rather than putting the emphasis on the people who live there, on the monastics. It is an environment in which time and space takes on a form that is in contrast to the conventional world around us. It is an environment that is formed by the heart. It's a heart environment over against the conventional society and conventional environment in which we live. And the reason why this is so important to me is that, well, first of all, these monks come and go. Nobody stays forever in the monastery. We shouldn't put such a great emphasis on this forever as we do, especially in our tradition. There's a difference between the Eastern and ours. But with us, it's either you have a certain time in which you can make up your mind, and that time is fairly long. It may amount to something like a decade. But after that, you make up your mind, and either you're in or out, you see. Who guarantees you that you are even living 10 more years? Who guarantees you that you live one more day? Any of the monks that enter the monastery. So my point is, you always enter it only for a time. But you may say, until I die, and that may come sooner or later, or you may right away say, I'm only joining this community for a year or for 3 years. But in the West, we have no no normal provisions. There are some exceptions, but we have normally, we make no provisions for that. But let's look at it in this context now, and then all sorts of things begin to happen. We see that people can, if they come only for a time, go back to the environment from which they come and rotate through this monastery. They can spend only a certain time. What do we do in the monastery, however? That has to be seen first. What is that? What is done in the monastery? It is a special spirituality that is cultivated there, and that is in contrast to the spirituality of the conventional world, a conventional society, the society without a heart, in which everything is arranged in a heartless way, or very largely so. Well, I will tell you what we do in the Benedictine monasteries. There are three vows. I'm always amazed at the many vows that other monks take. We take only three vows, and it often comes to a surprise to Christians. That we don't, in the Benedictine tradition, we don't even make a vow of celibacy. That is understood, but it is not explicitly vowed. I never took a vow of celibacy. I never took a vow of poverty. That is also understood. That is included, but it's not explicit. So what we call vows is the explicit vows, what we explicitly vow, and that implies, in our case, celibacy and poverty. But we make three vows, and the first one is the vow of obedience. And that binds us to the abbot. There are these three, the abbot, the community, and the rule. The vow of obedience binds us to the abbot because the abbot interprets the rule, and it is a personal bond. And we enter into a relationship to the abbot by this vow of obedience, by which we now, through the method of obedience that is practiced there, are supposed to learn the virtue of obedience. And it is very important, there was a question about obedience before, it's very important to take these two apart and distinguish them very clearly. The method of obedience is that you do what you are told, and you do it promptly and precisely and wholeheartedly. And by this method, you are supposed to learn something which is a basic attitude. This is an action. This is activity, obedience in that sense. But obedience as a virtue is the listening with your heart, moment by moment listening to what is it time for now? What am I supposed to do? What is the right thing to do? The very term obedience comes out of the biblical tradition in which there is so much emphasis on the word and on listening, and the idea is that the image that stands behind it is that everything there is can be understood as word of God. Ultimate reality speaks to me. God speaks to me, tells me something, and I can respond. I can listen to it, and I can tune into that. And in the process of tuning themselves in to what reality tells them, people have found that there is a great deal of static that's going on. There's always this static. I can't get this station. There's this static. It's like as if you were trying to tune your transistor radio to a station that's hard to get because it's maybe far away, and there is some radio station right next door to you, and every time you turn this on, you get your own radio station. That's your self-will, your selfishness, your self-will. And so people long, long ago have already decided, well, we have to do something about it. And they said, let's shut that radio station that's right in our backyard down for a while. So just shut it down. And then we might have more of a chance to listen to this other one. And so this is what the method of obedience is. You simply dismantle your own deciding, yourself, all your deciding. with your own will. You see, you don't give up your own will. The better, the stronger your own will, the better. With your own, full own will, willingly, not willfully, willingly you resign your willfulness. Willingly you cut down this thing and you say, now I will do what I'm told. To practice learning to do what is right without being told. That is the important thing. We call the monastery a school of obedience. But if it's a school, we hope that you graduate sooner or later. See? And instead of that, in our monasteries, not only the teachers have tenure, the students have tenure. Imagine that idea. See? You remain a student forever. Well, it is true that in some sense you remain a student forever, but we should pride ourselves in turning out people who do no longer have to be told what to do because they have learned it and they are tuned into it now. And that should happen as soon as possible. See? And there is always the danger. Institutions, as I said yesterday, perpetuate themselves. And even an institution that teaches you obedience tends to perpetuate yourself. And before you know it, they aren't really trying to teach you the virtue of obedience anymore. They are trying to train you to always ask what you are supposed to do. And in my opinion, that is getting stuck in the method and missing the goal. But anyway, there is this vow of obedience that binds us to the abbot and binds us, if I understand it correctly, to learning as quickly as possible, to be really tuned in and to listen to what God, in Christian language, what God tells you in this present moment, and do it immediately and wholeheartedly and thoroughly. That's the first vow. The second vow is called vow of conversion of life. And that now implies, of course, all the poverty, celibacy, all the rest. It means living according to monastic standards. That binds you to the rule, but the rule as interpreted also by tradition and by constitutions and so forth. But there is this letter of the rule, and the rule of St. Benedict has lasted for 1,500 years and proved itself marvelously adaptable and marvelously supportive for monastic life. And if we make this vow of conversion of life according to the rule. Now, there are two words in Latin, and they are used in the rule, and scholars and monks have been quibbling which of the two words was used. One is conversio for this vow, and the other one is conversatio. Now, this is a very important quibble, because conversio means a once and for all conversion. Conversatio means that you have to do it every day again. See? Again and again and again you have to turn around. And you can tell from how I've set this thing up that my conviction is that we are making a vow of conversatio, that we do have to do it over and over and over again. You see, it's not just once and for all. That was well expressed yesterday. I've forgotten by which speaker, but that when you take the robes, that's the starting point. That's not the end. That's not the one conversion, and now you're converted, and you can rest on your laurels for the rest of your life. This is where you start, you see. This is where the conversatio starts, over and over and over again. And the third vow we take is the vow of stability, often misunderstood as local stability. That means that you never go out from this place anymore. Well, that's easy to misunderstand in this place, because it binds you to the community and to this particular local community. See, in contrast to other religions in the Catholic Church, monks and monastics do not make their vow to an order that might send you somewhere else. You join them in California and they send you to China or something like that. That has its own advantages. But for monks, you join this local community. And you belong always to this local community. And with this little group of people in this clearly circumscribed environment, you will work out your monastic life. That's this pressure cooker situation in which we find ourselves, and that has great difficulties and probably great disadvantages, but enormous advantages, you see. You know you will not get rid of that person. That person will be with you for the rest of your life. There's no way out, you see. Well, that you can imagine that has power in training you for this. We are one. You see, this is always what it's about. It goes about training you to arrange your life according to your heart. Your heart says to you, when you really listen, there is no they and we. There is no this other nasty person and me. We are one. So treat one another as one. Even that commandment, famous commandment in the book of Deuteronomy, love your neighbor as yourself, does not mean, rightly understood and rightly translated, there's this neighbor out there and you are over here, now you better love him and you better treat that neighbor nicely. It means, best translated maybe, love your neighbor as, parenthesis, being, end parenthesis, yourself. Love your neighbor because your neighbor is yourself. There is only one of you. See? There is only one. Love your neighbor, self. That's how the Hebrew is best understood and best translated. So if you have a person with whom you have difficulties, that's how you have to treat them. This is me. And now, for the rest of our lives, we have to work that out somehow. And that is why of stability is so important. So interesting parallel, I don't want to belabor that, and we might be able to explore that a little later, but there seems to be an interesting parallel. We make these three vows to the abbot, to the rule, and to the community, so to say, the obedience and the conversion of life and the stability. That parallels the Buddha and the Sangha and the Dharma, you see. The rule would be Dharma, Buddha, the abbot, and the Sangha, of course, the community. So I think there's something deeper there that I haven't explored yet. Okay, now imagine now, how can we give people a share in this? Surely you can do this for a time. It will not have the same effect than if you do it for a long time, but you never know how much time you have. And so the question is, nobody knows how much time they have. Even if they are very young and commit themselves for life, they may not be there very long. That's always to be kept in mind. So my question is now, is there some model by which it might be possible in the context of Benedictine monastic life to give a share to those many, many people who have this hunger for monastic life in this form of monastic life? Is there some model? And how can it be shared? And fortunately, there is a model that is 1,000 years old, and we have had it for 1,000 years, but we haven't paid very much attention to it. And it comes from the Camaldolese tradition within the Benedictine order. Well, the Camaldolese were always Benedictines, but they were not formally associated with the Benedictine Confederation until very recently. And I happen to live now in a Camaldolese monastery. I knew nothing about this when I went there, but I had discovered this pattern of life, this model, before I ever heard anything about the Camaldolese. And it came as a great surprise to me that they had it 1,000 years ago. And their model is this. This is now the model for monks. It's nothing yet to do with lay people. The monks. The Camaldolese Benedictines have not one focal point or one environment for their monastic life, like all the others, namely the cenobium, that means the community monastery. That's a cenobium, a community monastery. But they have two other poles. And the two other poles are the hermitage, which according to the rule all Benedictines should have, but they deny it. So anybody else who reads the rule is not a Benedictine will say, look, he writes this very clearly. He says that monks should go into the hermitage. Well, the Benedictines have a paperclip over this. And the reason is this, you see. Saint Bernard, one of the greatest monastics, and the great saintly monk, expressed it very well. To our disadvantage. He said, if that person is good enough to become a hermit, we need him or her. If he is not good enough to be a hermit, he or she needs us and can't go into the hermitage. And on that pattern, nobody can ever go into a hermitage, you see. So we have been following this thing very carefully, most of the monasteries, and only recently have hermitages come in vogue in Benedictine monasteries. But the Camaldolese have always had that. They have the cenobium and they have the hermitage. And then they have a third pole, and that is outreach into the world. So the monk is also expected once in a while to go out into the world, not simply to go out and become again what they were before, but to go out as a witness. See? So you have here three forms of this changing the environment or of living over against the conventional society, a new kind of society, the society with a heart. You have on the one hand the cenobium, and that's a reconstruction, an alternative society, if you want. Then on the other side, you have the total disengagement from society altogether as the hermit. And then you have in the outreach a witness to society, a witness from that society of the heart to the society without a heart. And all three are possibilities for each monk in the Camaldolese Benedictine tradition, and they are expected actually, this is the ideal, not very often in practice honored, but the ideal that the monk according to, each monk or nun, according to their own need in life and to the particular phase in life, swings back and forth between those three poles. Now, the monastery proper, in the narrow sense, the monastery, is only the cenobium. See? So these people remain monks, you would say, this terminology is not so terribly important to me, but for our point here, this is somewhat important. These monks certainly remain monks even when they're in the hermitage, well, that's obvious, but they also remain monks when they are witnessing out in the world, obviously. See, nobody doubts that. Now, what makes the monks then? It makes, first of all, that they have committed themselves to a totally different form of life, namely not this society without a heart, but the society that is formed from the wisdom of the heart and from the intentions of the heart. Now, once we have this pattern, it is really possible to ask why then a person who is not a monastic, who has and would make this deep commitment to living from that, from the heart, living that reality that is the basis of our monasticism, couldn't spend some time in the monastery, some time in the hermitage, and sometimes back where they normally live their lives, and also go back between these three poles when they come back bearing witness. That's quite a different way of being there, and a lot will have to be worked out of the kind of training that people will have to get in the monastery and how much training they will have to get. But time-wise, they may spend a great deal more time outside. And besides, for people who are now in middle age or even advanced in age, it may still be a possibility to say, yes, that's what I wanted all my life. Circumstances did not allow me to follow this calling, or maybe I just missed the boat when I had the chance and now I'm stuck here. But now I want to do that. I want to commit myself to living from that communal heart, from that heart that we have all in common. I want to get some monastic training for that as much as I can get, and I will not be able to stay in the monastery all the time, but I will come out and I will bear witness in the circumstances in which I find myself. Now, that is where, in that direction, you see that this is all very sketchy yet and sort of very up in the air, and I myself am not very clear, and that's good, because if I were too clear, it would just be some idea that could never be realized. But it is a direction. And I think we should in some way begin to look in that direction, and a lot could come from it. And I think that the great question is, of course, whether monastics will rise to that occasion. That the lay people will rise to it, I have no question at all. But will the monastics open their monasteries, make this available, make the monastery available for this kind of thing? That is the great question. And I think there's no better place of asking this question than in a gathering like this. And so I'm very grateful to you that I had the opportunity for doing that. And I am listening now for your answers when the time comes. Thank you. I don't know whether we should go right on, maybe.
Any questions from the audience?
Yes.
How do you spell Camaldolese?
C-A-M-A-L-D-O-L-I. And it's the name of a place in Italy where this St. Romuald, some thousand years ago, founded the first monastery of that kind. And that's...
I like that model. That's
you like
really
that model?
Nice.
Good. But they have nuns? Yes, they have nuns too.
Time frame between these poles? Are you speaking a couple years at each pole, like out in the world, or a weekend?
Yeah. Well, in practice, it is usually a fairly long stretch of time, except for the hermitage, where monks can maybe just go for a couple of weeks or even sometimes for a couple of days. When they are in the cenobium, they go out into hermitage and come back. And that is now pretty widespread also in other Benedictine monasteries. But once you go out into the world, it is usually for longer times. Although I suppose that going to conferences or giving lectures or things like that, of course, also of that kind. And that is much more readily possible in a Camaldolese Benedictine monastery than it is in any other. In any other monastery, it causes a lot more turmoil if one member goes out and then comes back. And I'm very sensitive to this turmoil. I understand it and I don't like it. But in the Camaldolese way, this is sort of expected and set up that way. Yes.
Actually, it sounds to me like what you're describing is very much like the Zen model.
Well, that is why I'm. Speaker says it sounds very much like the Zen model. That's why I'm very intrigued with the Zen model, and actually, I'm somewhat involved with. And that is part of an answer that was also raised here. Partly involved with the establishment of a new experiment in Europe where it actually started out as a Zendo, but because it is in Austria, a Zendo is very problematic in a country that is 96% Catholic or something of that sort. I don't know the statistics exactly, but in a village in the country where everybody is, where Christianity is really alive. I mean, it's very much alive. And so my original role, because of my contact with Zen Buddhism, was to help. I was very eager to see a Zendo there, but I also saw the problems. And so my original role was to help get this somehow adjusted with the population there. I mean, talk to the parish priest and talk to whoever else was the Bürgermeister and so the various other people that were important there and also to the people and make this come across. Amazingly, and I'm sure also because of this monastic longing in the hearts of even very simple people in the country, in a Catholic country today, this came across much, much better than anybody anticipated. And before we knew it, the pastor was sitting there in robes. We even put the robes on him. He was very reluctant to try that. But we said, look, that's what they wear for their kind of meditation. When you try it on, it sort of helps. It gets you into the spirit. So he was trying it. Of course, only for an evening or so. But there is a real integration there. And many local Catholics who have no intention of becoming Zen Buddhists or anything, they come and they practice there for a little while, or they even come and do their Catholic thing there. See, it's now open for both. So we have one group comes up, the parish council, and they pray the rosary there, and the Buddhists are also there, and it's no problem. And the Buddhists ring the Angelus bell every day at noon, because that is very important in the village. So you hear this little bell ringing. It comes from the Zendo, but the people pray the Angelus. Well, and the Buddhists also pray the Angelus. In fact, they sing it in Latin. See? So, because it's not Buddhist Christian, that's what we avoid. It is Zen and Benedictine, and the two go very well together. There's no problem there. So, and I see that if this were pursued, as you rightly suspected, that this could be one type of meeting place. But I would be also very eager that traditional monasteries, both Buddhist and Christian monasteries, would allow something of that sort to happen there and open themselves much wider. Many of them have what's called oblates anyway. That is sort of like the people in the Benedictine tradition who have received lay ordination. That would be the parallel. So they have them anyway. So this could be expanded and developed. Anyway, you saw that rightly.
A couple times it's come up and people talked about Zen ordination as lay ordination, and we don't consider our ordination to be a lay ordination.
What do you consider that ordination? She says,
I think from maybe a Theravadan point of view, it's a lay ordination, but I think from our Mahayana Zen point of view, we're not lay people per se. Mm-hmm. So it's more like what you were describing, that sense of having a monastic foundation and coming from, because the Soto Zen tradition is basis is in monasticism.
Right.
And it moves out into the community from that monastic base.
Yeah.
So I think that's more like what you were describing.
Yeah. Has everybody heard this? Has everybody heard?
No.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's very interesting. Yeah.
No, it wasn't very good.
Was not so clear. Well, basically, in the... you would call it lay ordination only in the Theravadan tradition, but in the Mahayana tradition, to which Zen belongs, it is not exactly a lay. These people who have received this lay ordination don't really consider themselves lay people. They do consider themselves, in a sense, monastic, but very much in the way in which I described it, but not living in the monastery, or not most of the time living in the monastery. Yes.
About this, it might be good not to look at it in terms of Theravada and Mahayana, but maybe to make a distinction between monastic life and bhikshu and bhikshuni ordination, which is something that isn't in both.
Yeah. Well, I am not familiar with those distinctions, and maybe Sister Sundra could tell us about it, or others. That will be a very helpful thing. Anyway, I feel we should switch now, and we will have plenty of opportunity later on for more questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.